So, good afternoon. This morning, Peter Crawford raised the question of different ways of filming in different societies, different cultures, as a problem, really. How to adapt your style of filming to the pace, to the rhythm, to the silences of another society, a different way of behaving as people. And I think the topic this afternoon is very close to this, although not exactly the same. Colette has suggested this topic of the problems encountered when one shifts from filming in one society to a different society, one culture to a different culture. And I think this came out of an experience I had and an essay that I wrote some years ago concerning the problem I faced when I shifted from filming in East Africa to filming in Australia. And I would just tell you a little bit about this this problem I encountered. In East Africa, we were filming among the Gie people, and then the Turkana, and then also the Boran in northern Kenya. And in all these pastoralist societies, we encountered a very similar cultural style. And some aspects of this style were that there was a great value placed on verbal expression, on being eloquent in public situations. Many important events were acted out in public as a kind of performance. For example, negotiation over bride wealth figures importantly in some of those films. And in these cases, there would be private discussions under the surface, but then it was very important to have a kind of public conclusion to these sorts of negotiations. So a great importance was attached to people who could speak well in public, who could be convincing and persuasive. You could say it's a kind of culture of conversation. And I think sometimes of the my colleague Dipesh Chakrabarty has written about Bengali culture in East India, this culture of conversation where people gather, particularly men. It seems to be somewhat split by gender. Men gather in places simply for the pleasure of conversation. You might find the same in a Greek coffee house and many other places in the world. We also found that among the Turkana, there was a kind of speculative way of speaking, a way of philosophizing with one another. For example, the Turkana would propose a problem, and then maybe sitting around a tree for a couple of hours, they would discuss this problem. And I give you an example. One man might say, well, suppose that the enemies were raiding your village and to steal all your cattle and your daughters and so forth. Who would you save, your mother or your daughter? And then this could be the subject for 2 or 3 hours of debate, which is better, to save your mother or your daughter. There was also a great interest, I think, in self-analysis. The Turkana, the GA, were very good at inspecting their own social systems and trying to analyze them, and being very interested in explaining this to outsiders. Things like kinship, things like ownership of property, marriage, all these important aspects of life. So there was an interest in sharing information, let's say. And then I think on top of this also a kind of positivist, literal approach to life, that facts were facts, and one could debate about the mother and the daughter, but there was a kind of sense of life existing in a kind of positive way, a literal way. So that shortly after making those films in East Africa, we went to Australia. We were, my wife and I were employed by an ethnographic film unit at the Institute of Aboriginal Studies. And we were expected to make films about Aboriginal communities around Australia. And we found that the the ways of making films that we'd become used to in these East African pastoralist societies seemed to be completely inappropriate to filming in Australia. And I came to think that there was a kind of mismatch between a style of documentary filming and a cultural style. There was a kind of contradiction involved. Because in East Africa, everything seemed to flow in a beautifully organized way for the filmmaker. It was an ideal culture in which to make films. People explained things very clearly. They were happy to talk about all aspects of life. And when public events occurred, they were filmable. You could film the kind of power play that was going on between major factions. So this cultural style of eloquence, of verbal expression, was very well suited to a documentary style that had developed in Europe, I think, that focused on individuals, that in which language was extremely important. And we found in Aboriginal society a very different approach to life. It's a culture that is highly allusive. That is, it alludes to all sorts of cultural knowledge that is not necessarily expressed directly. Highly symbolic in the kinds of references that are made. There's a very complex intermingling of myth, of story, of history, of painting, visual arts, of song, of dance. All of these forms of expression are interconnected in a complex kind of network. And then, and perhaps most important of all, there's a great value placed on reticence, what I would call reticence, the ability to withhold information, to be quiet, to listen to others. And you would often find that the most powerful person present in a group was the person who was saying nothing. And in a sense, people understood that the person saying nothing knew a lot, but the silence of that person was extremely powerful. Also, you could say there was an avoidance of public contention, public controversy. Great efforts were made to avoid fighting, because there was a lot of fighting in many situations, but it was considered very destructive socially, and a lot of work went into preventing conflict before it should emerge. So for all of these reasons, the techniques we had developed for filming in East Africa seemed completely inappropriate to filming in these Aboriginal communities. Especially, I think, the value we placed on verbal expression, which took all sorts of other forms. And I'll just give you one example, which concerns translation. I was making a film about a mortuary ceremony in the Tiwi Islands, which are just north of Australia, just off the northern coast of Australia. And many of the events in this ceremony involved short dances and songs and so forth. One of these dances included a song which, when we tried to translate it, the translation went something like this. Blue, the color, blue, 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 blue. And that really was the translation of the song. If you put that in subtitles on the screen, what would it mean to anybody? So when I say an allusive culture, a culture that alludes to levels of symbolism, this is perhaps a good example. Because the blue referred to a bird, the kingfisher, which has some blue feathers. But it's not about the kingfisher, because the kingfisher is associated with the crocodile. And the crocodile in myth and story is befriended by the kingfisher, who will warn the crocodile if there's danger. So the kingfisher will fly away and the crocodile is warned. And then it happened that the clan of the person who had died was, the clan totem was the crocodile. So the reference to blue actually referred to the clan association of the dead person. But how could you put all that in a subtitle just with blue, 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 blue? So this problem, you know, you could see it's multiplied many, many times over in a society that's extremely, well, the culture that's extremely poetic, extremely symbolic in this way. And I think that the way that documentary filmmaking has developed in Europe has favored certain kinds of cultural styles, and it's, in a sense, disenfranchised other cultures that don't are not as accessible. It favors cultures that are, in a sense, literal in their presentation and concept of facts and history, and cultures in which people are expected to speak, to be eloquent, which there's a value placed on that eloquence. And of course, the Turkana were perfect for this. And we found in Aboriginal society it was almost impossible to make films that really conveyed the complexity of what was happening. You could show the surface events, and often those surface events were quite spectacular in the way that we were discussing this morning. But there was no real understanding being conveyed beneath that. And I think my wife and I made something like 12 films in the period that we were filming in Aboriginal communities. And my view is that none of them were very successful. We never solved this problem. We tried to solve it in some ways through collaborative filmmaking, through having people within the society perform a kind of explication of events that were happening on the screen, a kind of commentary produced by people within the event, who had experienced the event and could then reflect upon it. But none of these techniques were very successful, I think. So what I would like to turn to from this introduction, really, is to the question of finding film styles that are appropriate to your subject. And it's not necessarily, your subject is not necessarily the culture of a particular people. Your subject might be your own intentions, your own purposes for making a particular film, how you want to approach a certain theme, for example. And the way in which you approach it, the themes that you choose to make films about, may call for very different kinds of approaches to your filming. And so what I'd like to do today is to show you these examples from some different films and say a little bit about some of the thinking that went on behind the approach that was taken with the camera, with the editing. And the first example will be from one of these pastoralist African societies, the GA. It's one of the first films that I ever made, called To Live with Herds. Very similar in culture to the Turkana. The films about the Turkana may be better known than this one. And my interest in this film was really to look at the kinds of post-colonial pressures that were being applied to the GA people shortly after independence. And the approach that I began with was really very much from a kind of British functionalist view of a society as a kind of self-regulating system, a well-balanced system. And then the question was, what changes were taking place that were attacking aspects of that system, destabilizing the system, and what kinds of administrative decisions were necessary to avoid that kind of destructive effect, and in fact to adapt well, for example, questions of, you know, processes of development, of nation building, of education and so forth, introduction of a modern economy. How could you do that with the least damage? How could you do that in a way that would take advantage of the cultural values of the society that was under pressure? And that's the way that film really developed, into a kind of critique of problems of post-colonial administration. So for this film, we adopted a kind of complex of strategies. One was completely to avoid a kind of authoritarian commentary, voiceover commentary, because this was one of the things that we had reacted against as film students, as anthropologists. All those terribly bad educational films we had been subjected to in school, in which really the images were simply an illustration to a lecture. These illustrated lecture films, in a sense, formed the kind of model that we wanted to escape from in making use of the new equipment that was possible then. And I'm speaking now of the 1960s, when the new cameras, the Eclair cameras, the Nagra tape recorders, were becoming available. And we, I think, were the first generation of ethnographic filmmakers who had access to this new equipment. So for the purposes of To Live with Herds, we adopted a kind of observational style, which involved refusing some of the conventions of fiction filmmaking on purpose, deliberately saying, all right, we cannot make a film in which the camera can be everywhere within a situation, because the filmmaker cannot be everywhere in the situation without disrupting it. Generally, you as an observer, you find yourself in a particular position, and you stay there. If you were Alfred Hitchcock making a film, then you could put the camera anywhere. You could put the camera in the fireplace, you could put the camera overhead, you could do a huge close-up on any person in the scene. So we refused, in a sense, this grammar of the fictional cinema. And we felt that by doing so, we not only were moving away from fiction toward a different documentary style, but we were bringing the audience closer to the subject in a way, because the audience's position became more closely allied with the presence of a real person in the filming situation with the filmmaker. So we restricted somewhat our camera positions, we restricted ourselves to avoid authoritarian commentary. I did provide some commentary, but it was very limited, and when I spoke, it was personal, and I didn't use a professional actor to speak. I spoke myself in the commentary. And we began to focus on spontaneous events as they occurred, being careful not to intervene, not to provoke anything, not to direct anybody to do anything for the film. So I think maybe now we should look at this first excerpt, which is about, not sure how long it is, it's maybe 12 minutes or so. It contains some different types of scenes. Some are perhaps more conventional, the kind of documentary you might have seen previously. Others are a bit different, and we can look at the differences later.
Ya bangun apa? Bangun rebet itu lo tahu cuma no. Ini cok iyo ki. Nyai bangun ke ketandaran. Ayo. Kamu cuma nggak mau jalan. Nak ya bang? Eh, kalau dia mau. Ah. I asked a cattle buyer if this had been a good auction. No, he said, there weren't many cattle. I asked him if he thought next month's auction would be better. Yes, he said, by next month people will be hungrier.
So I think you can see many aspects of filmmaking style which are very familiar today. But for us at this time, this was in the 1960s, it felt as if we were trying many new things. For example, using subtitles of conversation, which had not been done much before in ethnographic documentary. Other aspects of the filming, I think, have become so familiar that perhaps they don't seem at all unusual anymore, and they're suitable for many different kinds of situations. But for us, I think what was important was to give the audience a sense of being present, For example, when you're sitting with a group of people, the decision not to move around with the camera actually identifies the position of the filmmaker, the author of the film. The next example I'd like to show you is from a very different type of film with a very different objective. And I think we're focusing now more on the objectives than on the necessarily differences of, culture. This was a film that my wife and I made jointly in India about ideas, really, it was to do with ideas about still photography and to look at the practices of photography that were taking place in one small town, which was also a tourist destination for many Indian tourists. This film was made in the late 1980s. I think we began filming in 87. For a long time, we had wanted to make a film about photography, really through an interest in photographs themselves, finding photographs as objects, often as lost objects, photographs that you might find in an antique shop or a junk shop, which, of course, for some people had been their most personal and private possessions and somehow became disconnected from their sources, from the families that had produced them. And there were many other things about photography that interested us. The way in which photographs were often treated by films as a kind of transparent view of history, which we thought was false, a kind of false approach to photographs, which of course are mediated, are very much conditioned by circumstance, by the rituals of making photographs, the documentation of certain important episodes in life, like weddings, births, marriages, deaths, and so forth. And we ended up making this film in India, although we had thought, this is a film you could make almost anywhere in the world. But we happened to be in India for a conference, and our Indian friends said, why not make the film in India, because India has a very old tradition of photography. Almost as soon as photography was invented, there were studios appearing in the major cities of Calcutta, Bombay, and so forth. This is in the 1850s. but at the same time, there are many Indians who have never been photographed. So that within India, you have a huge range of experience of photography. You may see photographs all around you in on billboards, in magazines, in the cinema, in newspapers. But for many people, they may only actually have one photograph of themselves that was taken at some time in their life. And also, photographs serve many different purposes, from ID, you know, identification on licenses and examination papers and that sort of thing, to much more formal uses and ritualized uses. So we were convinced to make the film in India, and we ended up in a small town called Mussoorie in the foothills of the Himalayan mountains, where there are a fairly small, stable population, but then at certain seasons of the year, the town is inundated with waves of tourists who come from New Delhi, from Bombay, from Calcutta, and so forth. And we became interested in how there were different layerings of photography in this one small place, different types of photographs being taken, using different photographic technologies, all the way from very sophisticated cameras down to the old box cameras that, in which The negative is actually a piece of positive printing paper. All the processing is done within the camera itself. And then, of course, you have small photographic studios, and you have photography for touristic purposes, for tourists who come to this place. So we envision this film in a very different way from like the film you saw before, as a kind of kaleidoscope of different practices, different technologies, different layers of history, really, in which photography had developed over the years, so that you could actually identify certain technologies with the period in which they had first emerged. We were also interested in the town as a kind of surrounding visual environment for photography, how the photographs that were taken related to that environment and to other forms of visual representation, such as images of the Hindu gods, for example, and images from Bollywood cinema. This sort of background for image making, which was very deep and very rich within India. And we also wanted the film to deal with photographs as material objects, as a form of material culture in people's lives, not something that you simply look through to try to see the past, but as pieces of paper, in fact. So I think the difference here was, the question was how to develop a style of filming that matched this sort of intention. And we ended up, I think, with a film that's full of juxtapositions of different kinds of material. The film weaves its way through on a kind of journey through different sorts of photography. There are no necessary links between specific parts of the film. We decided at the very beginning there should be no commentary, and there should be no central character, no central protagonist, and there would be no chronological narrative, in order to underline the fact that this was, in a sense, an abstract film about an exploration of ideas about photography. And as well as we could, to have the images in the film express some of this complexity. So I think we look now at the next example. This is from a tape this time, so it will be... should be better than the last, which was off a DVD, copied off another DVD, copied off another, many generations back. Yeah.
I don't like. Why? I can't say. I don't like the color. You have to expose. You have to send somewhere. You have to deliver. You have nothing to do with the photograph. I don't like it. Black and white photography is very good and lasting.
कुछ फोटो वगैरह बनाए सब ड्रेस में और सामने पीछे दूर पर ड्रेस के ऐसा ड्रेस में बनाए ड्रेस है बच्चे के लिए बड़े के लिए मुझे से व्यू मिलेगा गंगोत्री जमुना ट्रिप पीक्स है वहाँ हाँ टूर पीस ऑनली टूर पीस यस मैडम ड्रेस है ऑल व्यू है फोटो ड्रेस है टूर पीस ओके कम पुट ऑन योर क्लॉथ कम कम வாங்க உதாசிலா ட்ரெஸ் வகை லேனா டூ சைட் டூர் பீஸ் டிஸ் சைட் நோ நோ தட் சைட் டெலிஸ்கோப்
கன் ஷூட்டிங்
கன் ஷூட்டிங் நாட் குட்
வெயிட் வெயிட்
தட்ஸ் எ வியூ ஹிமாலய பீக்ஸ் தட் சைட் கோ வாக் ஹிமாலய தட் சைட் ஓ பேபி ட்ரெஸ் டூர்
And one is this. This. I do not like. Oh, front. This hand? Oh, that's right. Yeah. You don't. This hand. Good. Good.
Okay.
Good. Your hand here? Huh? Oh. Smile. Right? Look up. Good.
ये मनोवैज्ञानिक वैज्ञानिक तरीका है कि मन की भावनाएं जो बाहर लानी है, तो इन ड्रेसों के द्वारा से खाली ड्रेस पहनते ही वो आदमी की फीलिंग हो जाती है। किसी की छोटी सी दाढ़ी है, पगड़ी बांध दी, उसको जब पगड़ी बांधते हैं तो वो फौरन अपने को सरदार फीलिंग करने लग जाता है। हम पठान की ड्रेस पहनते हैं, उसके हाथ में डंडा दे देते हैं तो वो खोचे खोचे बोलने लगता है, उसकी भाषा में परिवर्तन हो जाता है। गब्बर सिंह की ड्रेस पहनते हैं, उसकी भावना में परिवर्तन हो जाता है, वो शोले का अपने को हीरो समझने लगता है या डाकुओं वाली फीलिंग करने लगता है। कभी बंदूक दिखाएगा, कभी पिस्टल निकालेगा या अपने साथी को वैसे ही धक्का मार देगा। तो मेरा कहने का मकसद यह है कि ये फोटोग्राफी आदमी की भावनाओं को जगाने के लिए ऐसा बढ़िया माध्यम है जिसकी भी टेस्टिंग करनी हो। एक दफ़े मुझे याद है कि नागालैंड का चीफ मिनिस्टर आया, कहा तो वो मुख्यमंत्री था, हमने उसको ये गब्बर सिंह का ड्रेस पहना दी, वो भी बड़ा खुश होने लग गया। तो फौरन हमारे आपस साथियों में देखा कि यदि एक तरफ तो ये चीफ मिनिस्टर है, दूसरी तरफ कहीं चोर है, क्योंकि इसके मन की भावनाओं में चोरी की कहीं फीलिंग है।
Now, how do I show it to you? Should I put it up here? These are the really, oh my gosh, the whole thing has come up. There. Now, this is my eldest brother-in-law, my father-in-law's eldest son, and his second son. Sweet, they aren't they? Look at the way they dress them. And here you can see the difference in the age, the four brothers, the eldest one, second one, third one, and this is my husband. Now this is up in Mussoorie. We have this lovely house here, at least not mine now. And it was called the Chateau de Kapurthala. And he used to have a lot of fancy dress parties and dress the children up. I think this one is very sweet. Very sweet with their little bow ties and whatnot. This was up here and created quite a sensation because all in French costumes. Here they are bigger, all at Eton and Harrow. Now this is myself when I got married. I had my 18th birthday in Europe actually. What is very amusing now, when people see these things, they know, who is this? So now we come to Cecil Beaton. I think this was one of the first ones he took. He nearly broke my neck doing this, but I had to get it at that angle. Now here, Cartier asked me to wear these jewels. This was tiara he had designed. And then this was a necklace, just a plain rope of diamonds with a tassel. And he was very fond of this bracelet he'd made. I couldn't afford to buy any of it. Now this is my father-in-law's palace in Kapurthala. Now this is by Cecil Beaton. And you know what he said to me? I'm tired of taking soft pictures of you, and I'm going to take this one. And why he made me hold a quill in my hand, I wouldn't know. But if you see, all the lines are very square. got my jaw straight. I said, but Cecil, I haven't got a square jaw like that. She said, doesn't matter.
Well, this is only a short fragment from this film, but may give some sense of the way in which the film moves between different registers, different social groups, different types of photography. And therefore, it has this very different approach to the both the photography and the editing. And I come now to more recent times. This morning, those of you who were here this morning saw part of a project which began, in fact, with filming at an elite school called the Dune School in northern India, and is perhaps the most famous school in India. I went there with the original intention to look at the school as a kind of crossroads for people coming from different backgrounds, students with different religions, students from different parts of India, and so forth. But I very quickly changed my approach to the school, and I became interested in the school as a kind of micro-society, with its own rules, its own rituals, its own habits of dress, and so on. And I became interested in looking at the school's, what I called its social aesthetics of the school, how the design of the school permeated all aspects of life, from material objects like the clothing you wore, the utensils you used to eat, the way that the dining room was organized, the way that students were living in their dormitories, to slang, forms of slang that had grown up specifically in this school, habits of gesture, of posture, all these small aspects of life that make a particular place and a particular community distinctive and characteristic and immediately recognizable to people who go away from there and come back to it. And perhaps only by going away from it and coming back to it do you see how it has developed its own distinctive culture. So I began thinking of schools and other institutions as these cultural enclaves or islands. And of course, this has been discussed by other people like Irving Goffman, the idea of the total institution in which patterns of life are highly regulated. And I think this sort of what I would call a hyper-aesthetic society occurs in certain institutions that are easy to recognize, like the military, or in hospitals, for example, or in religious orders, religious groups. And, of course, in schools, boarding schools, where people live in an institution for most of the months of a year. So that was one interest I had in the Dune School, was to try to look at the institution as a set of organizing principles that were worked out through material culture, through ritual, through more informal kinds of behavior. The other interest I had, and we'll look at this worked out perhaps in the excerpt after this one, is a much more experiential approach to how students who enter such an institution experience it, how they make sense of a system that is new to them, how they adapt to the system, and then how they perpetuate it for later generations of students. So that aspect of the filming we perhaps talk about a bit more later. But in the first film that I made at Doon School, I was more interested in the institution in a more general sense. And so this film, which is one of five films that I made there, is the most abstract of the five, the most general, although it does have some protagonists who appear at certain points. And it's organized in a more formal manner. And the organizational structure is in a set of chapters, 10 chapters, each of which tries to develop a different theme. And each chapter begins with a quotation from one of the texts that I found in the school archives. So these came from speeches that had been made or from articles that were written in the school newspaper, for example. I tried to find these texts as sort of emblematic of different aspects of the school, of its history, of its ideology. So the film is organized in a certain way to expose some of these principles. And what I wanted to show you is the opening, about 17 minutes, I think, of the opening of the film, which tries to announce a number of these themes, but also to establish for the audience what kind of film it is and what are the rules of the game of this film. And I think this is a principle we can see in any film that every filmmaker has to address, is how you tell the audience what they're going to see, how you tell them what sort of film it might be that they're beginning to watch, what kind of expectations you might create in the audience that will carry them forward into the film. And also very simple things like, where are we? What part of the world? What genre of film is this? Is it, of course, most essentially, is it fiction or nonfiction? Or maybe something in between? What sort of pacing has this film as its sort of rhythm that it's establishing? A film that begins very, very quickly, very with a lot of fast cuts and so forth, may get into trouble later in the film if it slows down a lot, if it changes its style. So it's a kind of telegraph, you know. The filmmaker is, in a sense, acclimatizing the audience to a particular mood and a particular set of themes and a particular way of looking at those themes. And I think all films do this. And it's interesting to see how they do it. And the fact that at the beginning of a film, you have to do so many things simultaneously, in addition to simply developing who might be in the film, you have to also establish where we are, raise certain questions. I don't think you should attempt to answer all the questions at the beginning, but provide some sort of context that you can carry forward in the film. And what sort of things we should be looking for in the film that will follow. So the structure of this film is clearly very different from the kind of kaleidoscope of the last one or the more observational style of To Live with the Herds. It's intentionally a kind of collage of formal elements and thematic elements and stylistic elements that will tell you the film is going to progress in certain kinds of scenes. And also perhaps say something about the relationship of the filmmaker to the subject. What kind of relationship does the filmmaker have to the people in the film? How do they feel about being filmed? This varies tremendously from one film to another. So it's part of the filmmaker's responsibility, I think, to give a sense of that relationship. And of course, part of it emerges, instinctively, intuitively, simply through the way that the film is, the kind of visual language of the film, the way it is looking at its subject. So perhaps we could go through some of the these aspects of the film after you see the excerpt. This opening, I think, more or less announces the various modes in which the film will proceed, and we might talk about that afterwards.